important being a resident in a nursing home was to the risk of getting COVID, and we know that elders are at very high risk of dying of COVID. So those data should be available. We need data transparency. And that is something that should be embraced by every jurisdiction. It's something that the Biden administration has talked about. And it doesn't seem to have been the case in New York. It matters not only where people die, but where they got infected.
Dr. Mary Bassett, we want to thank you for being with us. Former New York City Commissioner of Health, now the director of the FXB Center for Health and Human Rights at Harvard University. One of the lead authors of the Lancet report will link to public policy and health in the Trump era. Remember, wearing a mask is an act of love. Where to? Democracy Now! Is produced by an amazing group of people. I want to thank Renee Feltz and Mike Burke. Special birthday greetings to Brendan Allen. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Danny Glover, and I want you to listen to what I listen to, Hard Knock Radio.
Yo, this ain't your boy, this your brother, Ice Life.
Mm-hmm. And this M1 International, RBG all day, baby.
On Hard Knock Radio.
Word up, from 4 to 5.
Check it out, yo.
Can I be the one to bring you joy? What's up, y'all? This is Lettucey with Hard Knock Radio.
Right now, we're sitting in front of one of the most controversial figures in American politics right now and discourse. Well, he's controversial now, but always a fun guy to hang out with. Talking with author, preacher, professor, Michael Eric Dyson. How are you?
Brother David D., always good to see you, man. One of the most prophetic and insightful and brilliant cats I know. So anytime I get a chance to holler at you, it's all gravy, man.
So there's a lot to cover here. I saw you on Nightline the other day. I glanced through your book. You know, Bill Cosby, is he right? Or has the black middle class lost his mind? Just briefly, why did you write this book?
Well, I wrote the book, man, because I think Bill Cosby made some atrocious statements. Most people didn't hear the entire context. They just hear that he basically said, hey, stop, you know, spending your money on gym shoes as opposed to education, get your priorities straight. Now, it's hard to argue with that, right? But when you begin to, as Jay-Z would say, break down the lines, break down the speech, you begin to hear what was behind that speech. For instance, he said, pretty soon you're going to have a DNA card in the ghetto to determine if you're making love to your grandmother. Now, what does that mean? He says, well, she has a baby at 12, then the baby has a baby at 13, he's 14. How old? He said, I'm just doing the math. He says, I'm just trying to keep you from having sex with your grandma. Then he said, you name your kids Shaliqua, Taliqua, Muhammad, and all that crap, and they're all in jail. Now, when you start listening to some of the bitter animus and the vicious assaults on the poor and the black and the young, we haven't even gotten to that, baggy pants and body modifications and saying they don't know anything about Africa, saying they're more licentious than anybody else. You know, when you start looking at it, it just sounds like a blur of stereotypes. It's more than an old guy who's crotchety and mad at young people. That you pretty much expect. What's different here is that his anger is on steroids now, so to speak, so it's bloated beyond recognition. And it's been beefed up as a result of his intense dislike, I think, for black youth culture, for most of hip-hop culture, and he makes no distinctions in the so-called redemptive and edifying and the destructive and degrading. And furthermore, I think he has an extraordinary disdain for the poor that is a century old. I write in my book about the notion of racial uplift, where the black elite for a century and beginning after emancipation tried to convert poor black people into Victorian citizens with their Victorian values. And some of that stuff was good. Most of it was horrible. And Mr. Cosby is but the most recent update of a century-old tradition.
You know, I followed Cosby for a long time, and what he said and done is pretty consistent, whether we agree with him or not. And I guess there's twofold. One, let's go back into history when he was doing the Cosby Show. He used to come down on the black comics. He took issue with Eddie Murphy. He took issue with a lot of the up-and-coming black comics, if you remember, who were cursing. And he would make some of the remarks about them ruining the culture, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There wasn't that much of an upcry then. Why not? Why 20 years later? Because this guy has been doing this all along. Is it because CNN and NBC and the networks blew it up this time, and do we have to look at the role that they played and why they conveniently blew it up in 2005? Or is it because his remarks were really crossing the line, but it seems like it's consistent?
Well, you point out a very important point here, that Mr. Cosby has for a long time, 20 years at least, had some kind of criticism of black comics. Now, that's an internal comedic family dispute. You know, when they're jumping on Cosby and Cosby's jumping on them, when Eddie Murphy is doing his imitation in Raw and saying he called Richard Pryor up, who said, tell Bill to have a coconut smile and shut the crap up. And then, you know, Cosby saying that young people are just doing the terrible thing. Stop the cussing. It's not good. So yeah, we ain't met. Love you, guys. So the thing is, that's one thing to have an internal comedic debate among the fraternity. All right. Even though he's vicious, when you think about his response to Wanda Sykes on the Grammy show a couple years ago, when she came up to him live TV in her ear, they're telling her to fill the time. So she goes up to Cosby. Here's a legend. Here's a guy that we love. And she goes up to him, Mr. Cosby, how did your generation of comedians and black comedians, you know, sustain themselves and do such heroic things? We spoke English. Now, that ain't necessary for you to holler at her like that, like she's dumb and stupid and ain't speaking no English. Now, that's different than what he did, even though it's in the same spirit, and you're right, consistent with his viewpoints, but what he did in 2004 on May 17th, there, not in a comedic routine, but in a speech accepting an award given to him and his wife on behalf of the NAACP, the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, and Howard University at Constitution Hall in Washington, D.C., Constitution Hall, where I think Eddie Murphy might have done one of his stand-up comedy acts, maybe Raw even, where Mr. Cosby suggests that these people who are poor are a danger to the community and are a horrible drain on the moral and ethical values of our society. Now, that's different. Now you are crossing the line. And yeah, the white press happened to be there. Excuse me, Cosby has made similar statements at graduation speeches. It doesn't make them any more acceptable because he made them at, say, Morehouse, where he has allegedly called people up and dressed them down for their education. This from a man who dropped out of 10th grade, what? After failing, what, three times. Flunked the 10th grade three times. Sixth grade, his teacher said, Cosby is, more interested in clowning than studying. Well, that's good, because he was a clown. He was a genius as a clown. Then he dropped out of that 10th grade, went to the Navy, got a GED, enrolled in Temple, dropped out after 2 years. They gave him his degree based on life experience. Then he was invited to do a master's and doctor of education. Then he wrote a dissertation on Fat Albert, and his own dissertation committee member said it was an empty credential. Now, I don't think that's true, but the point is, he's had his own problems in terms of his educational pedigree, and I think that he needs to be a bit more humble and cautious about viciously assaulting poor people who have not had the same benefits and advantages, even though we want poor black people to be held accountable for their behavior. We don't want to exempt them from the same moral critique that we apply to everybody, but that's the point. Let's apply the moral critique across the board. So finally, for me, I think what's different here is that, yeah, I'm sure the white media played a role in it in Washington, although Hamil Harris was one of the ones who heard the speech, and he's a black writer for the Washington Post, but the white press But I think what's important here is to understand that Cosby has made statements for so long, at least for the last decade, that have been quite problematic that he's never been called on. So perhaps it took the mediation of the white press to call him on something that the black press should have been in his nostril hairs for in the first place.
We're talking with Michael Eric Dyson about his book, Bill Cosby, Is He Right or Has the Middle Class Lost Its Mind? One of the things that we have to look at is the fact that we have more middle class than ever before, but yet we are economically, politically, and socially even worse off than we were in years past. You go to a lot of places where, even up here, UC Berkeley campus, where you find people from middle class backgrounds who feel like they need to adopt a gang culture. For example, I've been to a party where people are claiming gang signs, knowing darn well that they've never been in a gang. There's the old adage of people wanting to associate with what one might call antisocial behavior or dumbing themselves down just to fit in. So, in other words, one could make the conclusion that the middle class has not lived up to all the resources and potential that it has. And in effect, since he was talking to that audience, a lot of what he says could easily apply right there. And why not let it just apply right there? Mm-hmm. Or do you think that audience would not see that their own kids aren't living up to the standards, you know, that they ought to?
No, see, you made a brilliant point. If Cosby had made that, then we wouldn't be having no conversation, or our conversation would be different. He needs to take you with it, bruh, because you make some arguments that God simply didn't make. What he didn't say was that, look, what you've brilliantly done, you've critiqued both the kind of ghetto-centric culture that valorizes a certain thug mentality that, and look, I'm a guy who's open to a whole bunch of stuff. I ain't against thugs and gangsters and Macs if they got real legitimacy and power and insight, because the real thugs and Macs and gangsters challenge the so-called legitimate rule of law and show the underside of it in the best way. Look at The Godfather. Godfather was a serious critique, a searing critique of the practices or hypocritical practices of American morality. So if you're doing something that sophisticated, if you're doing Scarface, who is one of the most, to me, underrated guys out there, if you're doing something with that complexity, then I'm down with you. Now, if you're doing, I don't know, MC Ren or some, you know.
Oh, you're talking about Scarface the rapper.
Yeah, Scarface the rapper. Right, right, right.
Okay, I thought you was like, you said, did you say Scarface, the guy in the movie?
Meet my little friend. No, I'm... Let me introduce you to my little friend right here. No, I'm not talking about Pacino's Scarface. I'm sorry. Thank you, bro. Your wide cultural reference is helpful here. No, I'm speaking about when they used to call me Grammy. You know, I'm talking about my man, Rob Jordan. Is that his name?
Brad Jordan. Yeah.
Brad Jordan. So I'm speaking about him. And I think that, again, if you have some complex understanding of gang or thug culture, then I want to hear from you. You know, there's some interesting moments on the Games album about that powerful metaphor of Eric Whitehead, Jerry Curl juice dripping on Ronald Reagan's shoes. What a powerful metaphor. Now,
just for the record, when Eric Wright, a.k.a. he went to the White House, he was with George Bush. Somebody didn't tell Game. But it makes for good metaphor. But just for the record, we have to know that that's a glaring mistake for those who remember that Easy went and saw George Bush Senior.
Right, exactly. You know, I'm thinking about the Reagan Hunter, so that George Bush was an extension of his 4 years. Thank God it wasn't 12, eight like his son, but it was a 12-year Reagan Hunter, which includes the 8 years Ronald Reagan was in office and the 4 years that Bush was there. So we're providing Game some latitude of metaphoricity. But the point is, but otherwise you got some silly, inane, reductive, you know, bling bling stuff that really doesn't speak even to the folk from which it emerges. So, I mean, most art and commercial culture, of course, is at a low level, and hip-hop is no different, although you have some extraordinary geniuses and some very good people.
But a lot of, let's go back to this, a lot of middle-class people are controlling it.
Right.
I mean, even in the music industry, the presentation, BET, if we have criticisms of that, that's not poor folks running that. Those are very middle class, upwardly mobile folks who have played into the stereotypes.
Yeah.
And Bill might have very well been talking to them.
Yeah.
We also have, you know, radio stations. I won't name names because I know you got to go on a lot of them. But there are some that are black owned, where they are owned by upwardly mobile middle class, but it's not reflected in the value. values that they hawk day in and day out. So that those criticisms could easily be launched to that audience and make sense. Okay.
See, that's a brilliant point. But Cosby wasn't making that point. See, if Cosby was saying, look, it's not the poor folk, the Negroes who ain't got no cash, who have no access, because how are you going to hold the black poor accountable for losing the value of the civil rights movement? What planet are you on? It is precisely the folk you're speaking about, the folk like you and me, despite being poor. Right. Upper middle class, middle class, upper class, who have squandered the moral capital that the civil rights movement has made available and generated. So you're absolutely right. That's a brilliant critique. If Cosby had come out saying, the problem is that these middle class black people think that they're poor, and they're not poor. So stop acting like a gangster and go to Morehouse. Now, if he had said something like that, we'd be like, yo, Cos was bringing the big stick. Cos was pointing out the contradiction. Cos was pointing out the gulf between, you know, as T.S. Eliot would say, the ideal and the reality. And he breaking it off, you know, but that's Davy D's job because he ain't doing it. So the point is, you're absolutely right. The middle class has exploited the stereotypes that are there and available of who the authentic black people are. People like yourself who are hip-hop activists from the very beginning who present a much more sane, balanced, judicious, wise interpretation of the culture, who appreciate its values, but also willing to be critical from within. That's self-criticism. You are criticizing the culture that has made you and that you've helped promote. Cosby ain't being self-critical when he jumps on some poor black people, because he ain't poor. And I ain't talking about what you used to be, because he's been rich a lot longer than he's been poor. Number two, had he made the comments you're talking about, we would have been stunned by saying, yes, finally here's a guy who understands that it's the black middle class who has let the black civil rights movement down, because they have benefited from it, they have been advantaged by it, and they refuse to speak about their role and responsibility in the ongoing perpetuation of a legacy that is stereotypical. Because quite frankly, that night, Cosby's mind was full of a blur of stereotypes that distorted his perspective. Had he begun in the direction you're talking about, had he made the turn toward the direction you're talking about, we can apply that, but that ain't his words. Now you're taking his words out of context and using them to justify a much more brilliant, insightful analysis that, my God, I wish he could make. But I don't even think Cosby listened to it. Let me tell you what. I listened to Kanye West's All Fall Down. Now, there's a brilliant analysis of consumer culture by saying, look, all of us are self-conscious. I'm just the first to admit it. Then he says, I'd rather go to Jacobs and spend $25,000 than go do the right thing. And then later on the album, he says, do I have to apologize to Mos Def and them because I said I was going to rap about something great and here I am doing the same thing? That's self-criticism. That is awareness that consumer culture is so seductive. And Cosby, by the way, consumer culture, oh, I think you know something about that because you sold Jell-O Pudding Pop, E.F. Hutton, Kodak, Fords, and had them expensive sweaters. So please don't tell me that you've been exempt from a consumer culture that you now dare and deign to hit upon. If he'd have come along now, he'd have been selling Nikes and Reeboks, bro.
It's Michael Eric Dyson. We're going to take a break, listen to All Fall Down since you brought it up, and then we'll come back and conclude because I know you got to get to the next spot. We'll be right back.
Oh, when it all, yeah. All falls down.
This the real one, baby.
I'm telling you,
Chi-Town stand up. Southside, Southside, we gon' set this party off right. Westside, Westside, we gon' set this party off right. Man, I promise. She's so self-conscious. She has no idea what she's doing in college. That major that she majored in don't make no money. But she won't drop out. Her parents will look at her funny. Now, tell me that ain't insecure. The concept of school seems so secure. Sophomore 3 years ain't picked a career. She like, get I just stay down her and do it. Cause that's enough money to buy her a few pairs of new ears. Cause her baby daddy don't really care. She's so precious with the peer pressure. Couldn't afford a car, so she made her daughter a yeah, it's so long that it looked like weave. Then she cut it all off, now she look like Eve. And she be dealing with some issues that you can't believe. Single black female addicted to retail as well. And when it falls down, who you gonna call now? Come on, come on. And when it all falls down, man, I promise. I'm so self-conscious. That's why you always see me with at least one of my watches. Rollies and posses that drove me crazy. I can't even pronounce nothing past that Versace.
Then I spent $400 on this, just to be like, you ain't up on this. And I can't even go to the grocery store without some ones that's clean and a shirt with a team. We live in the American dream. The people highest up got the lowest self-esteem. The prettiest people do the ugliest things. For the road to riches and diamond rings. We shine because they hate us. Floss because they the greatest. We trying to buy back our 40 acres. And for that paper, look how low we are stoop. Even if you in a band, you still in the coupe. Come on, come on. And when it falls down, who you gonna call now? Come on, come on. And when it all falls down, I say, the police, that's how I treat them. We buy our way out of jail, but we can't buy freedom. We'll buy a lot of clothes, but we don't really need them. Things we buy to cover up what's inside. Cause they made us hate ourselves and love their wealth. That's why shorty's hollering where the ball is at. Drug dealer by Jordan, kid by... And the white man get paid off for all of that. But I ain't even gonna act totally other than that. I went to Jacob with 25,000 before I had a house, and I threw it again. Cause I wanna be on 106 and park, pushing the bins. I wanna act for all of it like it's all terrific. I got a couple past due bills, I won't get specific. I got a problem with spending before I get it. We all self-conscious, I'm just the first to admit. Yeah, come on, come on. And when it falls down, who you gonna call now? Come on, come on. And when it all falls down, south side, south side, we gon' set this party off right. West side, west side, we gon' set this party off right. Chi-town, Chi-town, we gon' show them how we get down. Now Selena, you just like a safe belt, you saved my life.
Okay, we're here with Michael Eric Dyson, and, you know, we've been talking a little bit about your book, and we've been talking off the cuff, just, you know, in generalities, but what are some key points that are made in the book that are going to compel people to really have to go read this?
Okay, the first thing is I give a serious background and backdrop to understanding Cosby, because you raised a very important point, what his history is. So I break that history down. Most people would be surprised to understand that Cosby has never been a racial activist. Cosby has never spoken explicitly about race, very rarely, in public. He said, I don't deal with color in my comedy. I don't deal with race. He went on the Phil Donahue show when he was asked a question by a woman. He resented it. He says, I am not an expert on race or blackness. Why are you asking me these questions? I resent people supposing I'm going to be a leader. He says, I am not a leader. I'm just a comedian. That's all. And I'm going, I agree with you, bro. So where'd you get some skills from? All right, that's number one. So my argument against him is not because, oh, he's a Johnny Come Lately, though he is. The point is, he just hasn't developed the skills to be able to parse complexly the issues of race in public. That's number one. In the second chapter, I deal with cell blocks in classrooms. I break down this mythology that black people who are poor spend more money on gym shoes than education. Because a study done by Elizabeth Chin in a book called Purchasing Power shows that the consumers who are black, who are young, are into are into communal consumption. Their consumption is about buying not only pleasurable items, but items that are practical and items for other people. So I deal with that. I deal with the fact that education, the disparities between the have-gots and the have-nots is wide. Cosby has to deal with that. He doesn't. I put it in the context. Third chapter, I deal with the names he talks about. Shaquille, Shaniqua, Taliqua, Muhammad. How about Condoleezza? How about Oprah? So my point is, don't beat up on people for what they're naming kids. Learn to love the people. Oprah, Condoleezza, Shaquille, Keyshawn, and then you can appreciate the names. But I do a whole chapter about the African practices. You know, black people have always been naming their kids after consumer products. Please, it didn't start with Alizé and Versace. Oh, I'm sorry, Versace. It started with what? It way before that. Listerine, Hershey Bar, right? And, let me say one more, and Cremola, and Cadillac, and El Dorado. And I'm telling you, there's a hell of a difference between, not the hell of a difference between those early generations, what's going on now.
And a lot of other ethnic groups do similar things, name their kids, you know, out of books that they read. So, yeah, that's just a thing.
Right.
Okay,
he was nasty about it, and he was nasty about it. Then I wanted to give the context. Let me tell you two more things, and we'll finish with you. So then I go into another chapter that deals with, his family values and his critiques of the poor black families. Let's take a look at Mr. Cosby's own family and see, has he been willing to live up to the very ideals he puts forth? And we find him wanting. Now, that's not a judgment against him personally. That's a judgment about his putting into public perspective the relationship between class and character, and we're suggesting there's no one-to-one relationship. And finally, I end the book by talking about poverty, the different views of poverty, the different views of responsibility, and how we must enable people to become much more responsible. And as Dorothy Day said, the great Catholic social worker, I want to work toward a world in which it's easier for people to behave decently.
Let me ask you this, and we get ready to close. One, if a homeless person walks by and sees that your fly is down,
right,
do we come back and say, how dare that homeless person who has his own fly down? Do we chastise them for doing that?
Okay.
You know, that's one. And the second thing is the fact that Cosby brought this up in public discourse, which could make people, especially the outside, misinterpret.
Right.
Could we apply that to you with the use of the N-word, which you've done on in public discourse, which in my experience has caused pain? You know, when I got to walk into corporate offices and all of a sudden Professor Dyson used it
right.
on C-SPAN.
Right.
So what's wrong with me using it? He said it's a term of endearment, nigga. You know, I mean, I've had to deal that with that in the music industry.
Okay.
So how do we deal with that? And you know.
No, good points. The first one, look, if the homeless person points out that my fly is down and his fly is down, we can help each other. You zip your fly up, I zip my fly up. If the homeless person starts making critiques about why my fly is down and what my moral perversity is, then we got a problem if his is down and he ain't taking his account. Cosby didn't just point that the fly was down. He began to make statements about the kind of pants we had on, why we had them on, and what the fly's openness meant, not recognizing his own fly was open. That's the part of the point there. So judge not, lest ye be judged. So with the same judgment that you judge, you shall be judged too. That's just straight biblical principle. Now, in terms of saying that, you know, my use of the N-word is comparable to Cosby's pain, well, I wish indeed that I had the kind of cultural influence that Mr. Cosby has by just flicking off a statement and a rant that has been covered nonstop for 365 days. My reference to niggerdom on C-SPAN certainly has been widely distributed. I can't lie about that, but certainly not anywhere near of Cosby. But I don't know if you realize that recently they discussed on the Tom Joyner show, and I did an interview with Tavis Smiley where I've given up the public use of the N-word. So I forgive you for making me say again here on the radio when I've given up the public use. See, they can always do this to me, man. Look, I've given up the public use of the N-word because it has caused people pain. And you're a guy I respect. You know, I debated Cornel West about this. I still hold, and he understands that I still hold to the position that it's a term of endearment circulated among black people. If white people come to you, Steph, you said Dyson used it, therefore I can. You tell them Dyson said this. That N-word is available and respected by and appropriated by black people among themselves. White folk never have access to that, period. So there's no misinterpretation there. And if they do that because they're trying to justify it through me, that's a misappropriation, and therefore you got to stop them there immediately. But I have ceased to do that publicly precisely because so much pain has been created by a prominent intellectual seeming to justify a term that so many black people find offensive. Now, the black people who know that I'm down with them and who, when I use that N-word, are going to still know that. But the black people who otherwise might hear me but can't hear me because of the use of that word now have no excuse but to hear what I have to say, because I will no longer engage in that. The Apostle Paul said, if meat offends my brother, I won't eat meat.
Okay. Last comments for you before we get out of here. Anything with the political landscape? Anything we should be looking forward, predicting?
Yeah, well, I think, look, Hillary Clinton is, you know, being ramped up to run for the presidency. You know what? She has done some conservative stuff. You know, black people always get hoodwinked by personal relations translated as political capital. So I think we should be very careful. I think the Mfume race in for the Senate in Maryland should, you know, shape up to be quite an intriguing battle for black political power. And I think that we keep our eyes on Senator Barack Obama. And if we look at his record so far, we want to begin to appreciate his genius, but also to ask questions about the relationship between his own voting record and the principles he puts forth. I think he's been remarkably consistent, but I think it's one thing to talk about your principles before you get in office, and when you get in office, the kind of compromises that have to be inevitably be made. And then finally, I think we should work now, not wait until another presidential election, to begin to register black voters and progressive voters and young people, because we are in an extended battle and contest bitterly for the future of this nation. So without reducing it to Karl Rovian evangelical terms, and I think it's very critical for us to register as many people so we can move forward in the movement.
capitalism is so real.
The same people that sell the sickness sell the pills.
The pharmaceutical companies in cahoots with bad meals.
The same people that sell the sickness sell the pills.
The mainstream rap in cahoots with private jails.
The same people that sell the sickness sell the pills.
Mainstream religions, no facts, just all pills.
The same people that sell the sickness sell the pills.
So what's up? If your mind is a weapon, then make sure that it's loaded. And probably keep it on safety, cause the world is thoughtful, they politically correct, no respect for the stoic. Such neglect for the steps of those repping heroics. Someone steps up, a whistleblower fesses up. Let's protect the rights for them to do it, I can't stress it enough. Cause the 1% got a poker face, let's call it bluff. Put their green inside of a toilet, give them a royal flush. Kings and queens from red shades to black spades. Back in the days, we raised rap to Jack Dangs. CNN for blacks, P.E. Chuck D. phrase. P.I.T. to X-Clan to A.D. We gave our flavor flame to tell the world, behave, we are no slaves. And while we dance, we'll take stands and part the waves. And part the seas, give healthy thoughts to fight disease. Show them hip-hop strength, Hercules, Hercules. Capitalism is so real.
The same people that sell the sickness sell the pills.
The pharmaceutical companies in cahoots with bad meals.
The same people that sell the sickness sell the pills.
The mainstream rap in cahoots with private jails.
The same people that sell the sickness sell the pills.
Mainstream religions, no facts, just all pills.
The same people that sell the sickness sell the pills.
So what's up?
What's the solution when powers were there abusing? No more of this here confusion. Conclusion of the collusions. Amusing how they portray us, then take and use what we say to turn right around and try to mimic how we live every day.
Now what's up with that?
They can give nothing back. Well, they put the dope off in our hood and blamed us for crack. And look at them now, they giving us masks to cover up the mass. It's from something they produced in the lab. It's a disaster.
The world we are living in is so cold. Hands high, don't shoot, got me kneeling on the floor.
Why they kneeling on our throat, trying to overplay their role? Suspend the suspensions with pay and let them pay what they sold. Lock us up and let them go.
I'm demanding some understanding.
Why is fast food so cheap, but it costs to eat what is planted? Uh-huh. Taking nothing for granted. This planet that we call home can call it a lot of things, but can never call it our own. I'm gone.
Capitalism is so real.
The same people that sell the sickness sell the pills.
The pharmaceutical companies in cahoots with bad meals.
The same people that sell the sickness sell the pills.
The mainstream rap in cahoots with private jails.
The same people that sell the sickness sell the pills.
Mainstream religions, no facts, just all pills.
The same people that sell the sickness sell the pills.
So what's up?
Knowledge, equality, justice, understanding. Power to the people, these streets demand it. Fires being fueled by the unjust rules. Look, universal law is the gavel. Tools, so many jewels, free yourself. Know the source, free force, let the energy rain. If you awake, you done seen the turn of the tides. Nothing new but the new clue gave birth to the rise. Seeing light for the first, bubbles burst, broke curse. God spoke, know your worth, the gold's tainted. Most times things ain't what they seem. Once you realize you're a threat to the regime. No hocus, we exposing the frauds. Learning as we kick open the door. They created the sickness, they created the cure. That's how the rich is getting richer, they at war with the poor.
Resource.
Neighborhoods abused by force, redlining, humans dying, history's course. Facts hidden and lost, but divine intervention kept us marching right on course. Wild rhythms, deep wisdom in the spin of the record. Generations fought, shine light on the skeptics. We see fakeness, our intention sacred. Third eye wide, exemplifying greatness. What's up?
Capitalism is so real.
The same people that sell the sickness sell the pills.
The pharmaceutical companies in cahoots with bad meals.
The same people that sell the sickness sell the pills.
The mainstream rap in cahoots with private jails.
The same people that sell the sickness sell the pills.
Mainstream religions, no facts, just all pills.
The same people that sell the sickness sell the pills.
So what's up?
It's 94.1 Hard Knock Radio. Davey D hanging out with you this afternoon. We are broadcasting from the National Political Hip Hop Convention. I'm going to be joined by Anita. She's out there on the convention floor, and there's a whole lot of things going on. But in front of me is somebody who I like, definitely somebody who I want to see become the mayor of New York City. That's my original hometown, for folks who don't know. His name is Mr. Charles Barron. How you doing, sir?
Well, thank you so much. I'm doing great, and I appreciate you giving me this opportunity.
Man, you know, New York politics, mm-hmm. You know, what do you have, like 75, 250, seems like city council people.
Yeah,
so you got to really be somebody who's strong.
Oh, yeah, man.
And you got to have a loud voice in order to cut through.
That's right.
And stand out.
That's
and
right.
Over the years, you've been one of those people. So maybe you can give folks who are listening a little bit about your background.
Sure.
And why it would be important for you to be mayor of New York, and also why you're here at the convention.
Exactly. First of all, let me just say I'm a child of the 60s. I came out of the Black Panther movement. I was in the Black Panther Party, the Harlem branch of the Black Panther Party in the 60s. And after that, I joined the Black United Front under the leadership of Reverend Herbert Daughtry.
I remember him.
And we dealt with every issue you can think of, the Michael
Youssef
Stewart
Hawkins.
Killing, Youssef, you got it.
Mm-hmm.
All the police brutality, anti-apartheid stuff. So in that transition from movement to government, every time we go to battle around an issue, we always run into some Uncle Tom, ain't your mama, sellout Negro politicians that block us. Mm-hmm. And we got to demonstrate, and we holler and scream, and they just continue to block us.
How do they get in a position to block us?
Because they got power. See, we decided that the system, we want no part of it. In the 60s, we wanted to tear it down. I was a revolutionary nationalist, still am. And that's why sometimes I say, ex-Black Panther, Councilman Charles Barron, do you have problems with that? And I said, yes, take off the X. I'm still a Panther to my heart.
Mm.
But we were talking about changing the system, so we didn't want a whole lot of being a part of it. And
right.
it was, and some of us felt it was a contradiction to try to get in something you saying that you need to radically change or tear down.
Right.
But the Black Panther Party ran Eldridge Cleaver for president on the Peace and Freedom Party. They ran Huey Newton for Congress while he was in prison.
Right.
And they ran Elaine Brown for the Assembly, and Bobby Seale ran for the mayor of Oakland.
Right.
So we you know, this is a struggle for power. There's two ways that you get change. One, you can continue to try to influence. Influence is when you march, demonstrate, mobilize, organize to try to get people in power to make decisions in your best interest.
Right.
Power is when you have that position to make it yourself.
Right.
So I got to the point where I said, this is not making any sense. I'm tired of calling people names. I'm tired of talking trash. You know, we need some power.
Right.
So in East New York, Brooklyn, where I come from, I said, I'm running for this city council seat. That's a
now,
powerful
seat. Now, East New York
seat.
Is next to Bed-Stuy.
Right.
And next to
Brownsville.
Brownsville. Those are the two huge
right.
historically black
right.
neighborhoods.
Exactly.
And Bed-Stuy bigger than Harlem.
Bed-Stuy is huge.
Yeah, a lot of people
whole
don't know
lot
that.
Of black folk. Brooklyn, you got more black people in Brooklyn probably than anywhere in the world.
Yes.
So it's a lot of black folk there. So I said, what revolutionaries need to do is to get into electoral politics instead of worrying about politics corrupting you. Why can't you be a cleansing agent? Why can't you get involved and still be you? They say, well, Charles, if you get in there, you know, they're going to change you. You can't do this. You can't do that. Well, I wanted to challenge my revolutionary friends and say, look, I'm going to get in, and I'm going to be as revolutionary as I was when I was not in. And that's what I attempted to do. So I ran on a platform of freeing political prisoners, reparations, all the stuff that we're talking about here in this hip-hop
convention.
So you
convention. Ran on reparations?
I ran on reparations. And then after I won and got in, I had the first hearing in the history of New York City on my reparations resolution, the Queen
right.
Mother Moore reparations resolution in the city council. I had another resolution on freeing political prisoners. Of course, I got beat up by the New York press,
right.
but that's all right. Those things happen. Everything's
so
political.
How do you manage to do two things? And also, Anita's joining us. She's walking in the room from the convention floor. But there's two things that seem to happen. When you're in political life, you know, having gone to the Democratic conventions and all that, it's real easy to be isolated. I mean, they make it very comfortable for you just to hang out with other people who are in elected office, and to the point that the folks who put you there can almost become a distant memory, you know.
Point.
And
good point.
While you're there, you got all the perks. Well, you know, Charles, councilman, if you pass this bill, kids can go to school. We can do this, all these different things. So how do you keep from having a relentless system from corrupting you when you know there's all the perks,
mm-hmm.
and when you know that there's a tendency just to isolate you anyway.
Right. See, the greatest challenge I had was that. The way I came in made it a little easier for me because the whole Democratic Party machine was against me.
Okay.
The congressman out there, the assemblyman, the county leader of Brooklyn, the former council person, all of the district leaders, I had no political politician supporting me at all.
Okay, so they weren't trying to hang out with you.
Hello. So
right.
I didn't owe nobody nothing because nobody did anything to get me in here but grassroots people. I took her to the hood. I went to the projects. I went to the beauty salons, the barbershops. I went to brothers and sisters on social services. I went to the brothers in the gangs. I went to the CUNY students. So I built a whole new constituency. So I came in free. So okay. I don't owe anybody nothing. I don't hang out with them. I don't go to their conventions. They don't put my petitions together to get me put on the ballot. I reject that. I put myself on the ballot with my movement. So I don't give them the $1,000. When you get in, you give them $1,000 and you can stay home and they collect all your signatures to get on the ballot. I don't do that.
You don't do it. So.
We collect our own signatures.
So you got
I
your
raise
own
my
thing.
Own money. They don't raise money for me. So I don't answer to anybody but my people, my God, my family, and myself.
Okay. Well,
and that seems to be a lot of pressure on one person. Like, what about connecting it and taking it out of individualized aspects of just one person acting alone and bringing more of that collective a sense of understanding? One thing that I've noticed throughout this convention is that people are looking at a way of transitioning the way we identify and select our leadership and also bring about a level of accountability. So it's also connected to community. So you don't have to be that lone soldier out there doing the more positive work, you know, coming against in contact
Boy,
with this all this crazy.
Hook that up, man. That would be awesome.
How would we go about doing
you
that?
You know, we got to do, and I always tell people, we can't subscribe to this single leadership concept, mm-hmm. this egocentric, charismatic, authoritative type leader. One at a time. Sharpton's replacing Jesse. You know, like we only have one at a time. Mm-hmm. Right. Whites can have a whole bunch of leaders. But when it comes to us, oh, you taking someone's place? When Sharpton ran for president, they said, oh, because I was out on police brutality issues. Are you taking Sharpton's place?
Charles Barron, the new Al Sharpton.
Right, right. That's what they would say. I said, please. First of all, I don't have a do. Different kind of head top here.
Right.
No, we ain't taking anybody's places. We have many leaders. And we got to look at leadership and not leader. When you want to build a fan club, then look for followers. When you want to build a movement, you look for a collective leadership, a collection of leaders. So I don't look for followers. I don't want nobody following me. I'm looking for leaders. I want people to join in leadership. The way we hold people accountable, our folk got to hold people to an agenda. See, it doesn't matter how good I rap or how, you know, a person can come and, you know, how we can and get our people around them. You watch the speeches and stuff, you know. You better watch a person's history. What have they done historically? And what is their positions on the policies? And we have to build a progressive, revolutionary political movement that says, bring the candidates before our movement. And if they adhere to our agenda, that's why I'm here at this hip-hop summit, that an agenda was put together. And we need to say, I don't care if it's Charles Barron or whoever it is, you come, you have to check out and adhere to this agenda to get our support. And you don't do that, you don't have our support. We're not raising money. We're not voting for you.
Right.
And then I think people in the hip-hop movement should run people for office. So you don't have to worry about Charles Barron being accountable. You know, like I respond to that in a very rough way in the community. Probably too rough when people say, I'm going to hold you accountable. Listen, I've been out here for 30 years, you know, an activist organizing for stuff to help you and didn't even know your name. So you cannot hold me accountable. I'm holding you accountable for voting for me to get you out to be more involved. Because to me, electoral politics is a tactic. It's not a panacea. It's not an end all. Got to build that movement to hold accountability.
You know, one of the things I wanted to find out, under Rudolph Giuliani, who they're now saying may be on the vice presidential ticket for the Republican Party, which puts him, you know, a breath away from being a president. What was it like working under him? How did you deal with him? And what were some of the types of tactics that he would use against, you know, somebody who would be outspoken? You bring in reparations and you got a guy like Giuliani in office.
Oh, man, he'll punish you. See, what happens, a lot of politicians get afraid to come up with stuff because they'll punish you.
Like well, how's that punishment show
this
up?
This is how it happens. You want $2-3 million to fix up your park in your neighborhood? That's in the capital budget. The speaker doesn't like you. The mayor doesn't like you. You're not getting that $3 million. You want to fix your libraries up in your community? You're not getting it. You want extra money to give out program money in your community? You will not get it. They will punish you. So then, if I'm talking all of this stuff, so yeah, Charles is deep. He's talking all that black stuff. Well, we ain't getting nothing for the neighborhood. We need to get him out of here. And they'll make sure that your neighborhood deteriorates. Fortunately for me, I came in right after Giuliani left.
Okay.
And when the new speaker came in, I think the wisest thing I did, I started a group called the Fresh Democracy Council. We had term limits in New York City, and of the 51 council members in New York City, 38 were new because of term limits. I got together with 25 of them before I got in, and we hooked up an agenda for democracy in the city council so that we wouldn't be punished too badly by the speaker.
Okay.
So when I got in, I already had me some relationships. I bonded with some of them. So the speaker knows that he needs us to pass the budget, to make land use issues. And if I can get some of my colleagues not to vote on certain things, and he saw that they weren't isolating me, the blacker I talk, because I came in there talking stuff, and you know, the pictures were on the wall. So why do you have all them white men up on the wall? That was the first issue. I said, I can't legislate in this place with all these white men up on the half of them had us a slavery. Thomas Jefferson's a slaveholding pedophile. That's how I came in. Hmm. And then reparations and political prisoners. So they thought they were going to isolate me. But then at the same time, I brought Robert Mugabe from Zimbabwe to City Hall. The first time an African leader been in City Hall, and a controversial one in their mind, because he's taking lands from whites in South Africa and Zimbabwe and giving it back to his people. Man, they called me everything but a child of God. The speaker went around and told all the council members, don't go to Charles Barron's reception. I don't want y'all to go. 18 of them came.
So he was saying that,
yes,
that bold.
Yes.
Wow.
I mean, me and him, we went at it. You know, he said, Charles, why you got to do this to me? Do what to you? Why you bringing Mugabe here? I don't bring my politics to you. I said, this is not your spot. City Hall belongs to the people. The Red Room, which is the most prestigious room in City Hall, that's our room. Am I doing nothing to you? I ain't even thinking about you. That's my leader. That's who I respect. And if you can go to Israel and don't even meet with the Palestinians, don't tell me nothing about any African leader I want to meet with. You do your thing, I'm doing my thing. This is City Hall. It belongs to the people. You don't own anything. That's the battling we had. Then the media tried to get my colleagues to criticize me, the New York Times. And they got mad. They wrote an editorial thing against me saying, why is the council so silent on Barron's, you know, bringing Mugabe to City Hall? And they wanted to get my colleagues to beat me up and couldn't find one to even criticize me, not even the conservative ones, because a mistake we made in the 60s, and we do to some extent now, revolutionary radical people, we scare people away. We scare them away with our personality. You know, we're so militant that we scare our own folk away. And a lot of that happened even in the 60s. So if you could stop scaring your people, you could still be revolutionary and progressive and be nice and not be so, you know, like a lot of people in the hip-hop community don't even want to smile. You know, they got to look mean all the time. And they, sometimes, you know, you got to be able to let your people know that, hey, I'm tough, I'm mean, but I will crack a smile.
Councilman Barron, you mentioned the whole thing of your history with the Panther Party, and then you mentioned the importance of hip-hoppers running for office. Why do you think that's so important?
You know why? Because nobody will carry your agenda better than you. See, when you have to count on somebody else to carry your agenda, they can dupe you once they get in. Now, I would never do this, but they don't know me. We just meeting each other. Say, hey, this is a good guy. Got a nice record and everything. You don't know what's going to happen when I become mayor. I'm going to be all right, and I'll probably do more radical stuff than you even tell me to do. But you don't know that, but you know you.
Well, what is it? What is it about those hip-hoppers? What is it about those activists and organizers that exist within our community? What would make them such the great, what would extend that leadership in making addressing certain issues?
Because they're powerful. See, they're fresh. Mm-hmm. They still got the fire in their belly. They're creative. They're geniuses. Look at their work. They know how to reach our people. We need more hip-hop politicians, not the traditional stuff that people go along to get along. You know, you get in there, so you're not supposed to do this, you're not supposed to do that. See, they don't want to hear that. When they get in there, it's going to be totally different.
Well, you know, when you say hip-hop politicians, and this is going back to something that Yvonne Buono put in her book, and I think you alluded to, but didn't say directly, was really taking the task of being in this arena very seriously. And, you know, it seems like you came up with a strategy, you know, to protect yourself. You understood the terrain that you're in. And maybe you could explain further, you know, how one has to prepare themselves in the arena of politics so that when people get in, that they know it's more than just sloganeering, which seems like an anticipated tactic that they would use now. Like,
right.
Oh, yeah, just go in there and sing a song. But you, obviously, you got to do more than that.
No, you better know how to organize. You better know how to negotiate. You better know how to bond with people. And you got to realize that some people you may not even like. Some people may against reparations, against your issues. Bond with them. Because you got to work with them each and every day. You don't have to like them. You can come out strong politically against them. But if you bond with them.
What do you mean when you say bond?
Mean, like, say if I see you every day and we on the opposite side of issues, you know, just how you doing? How's everything? How's the family?
Okay.
You get to know the person, to become personable. See, the difference between being an activist, I don't ever have to see my enemy. Because we out there demonstrating against them. We don't have to live with them. We don't have to rub shoulders with them. The difference, when you get in electoral politics, they're going to be sitting right next to you. The very people that got up and talked against reparations, talked against political prisoners, you're all going to have to work on a budget together. You have to work on legislation together. You see them every day. So, I mean, you can stay with a fixed attitude every day if you
and
want.
And you don't want to come in there with a sledgehammer and go upside their head?
Go ahead. Sledge them. Go ahead, hit them upside the head. And after their head is busted, you still ain't getting nothing. I mean, you can bust them upside the head. I do. Mm. And see, you can still do the sledgehammer, but do it politically. Mm. You can still hit them. You know, there's no larger critic of all of them in the city council than I. Mm. I beat them good. But you do it in a way that you don't destroy the relationship. You destroy them on that issue.
Okay.
You separate the politic from the person. Now, some of them are just no good people, and then you can sledgehammer all the way, bust them up, and don't worry about it. But there's a time where you say, I'm going to beat him down badly, because believe it or not, we're sharper than most of them. So if you know how to be passionate and not emotional, see, emotionalism makes you narrow. When you're passionate, you can still be sharp, political, piercing. You know, you can be a Muhammad Ali of politics.
Mm.
But he was charming. They liked him. People that didn't like him, didn't think they would like him, he charmed them.
He would smile as he beat
sharp.
You.
He was, right. But he still beat your butt. He still kicked your behind in that ring.
Right.
Once you got in that ring, he beat you down. Afterwards, he was still like, hey, you're a nice guy. You know, you can do that.
What about the whole thing of playing with the issues of politics? Last night, Slick Rick at the Hip Hop Political Convention forum, he mentioned that Kerry and Bush, lesser of two evils, and voting is a waste of time. What do you say?
Voting is not a waste of time. Kerry and Bush is two evils, and we shouldn't be voting for any evil. I agree with Slick Rick there. But when you get on a local level, forget the national scene for a second. Everything in your life is political. Whether your garbage is going to get picked up once a week or twice a week is a political decision. Whether the air that your children are going to breathe in your neighborhood is polluted because of incinerators and bus depots and waste transfer stations, environmental racism coming to your community is a political decision. You talking about reparations, the Slick Rip for reparations? What is he going to do? Is he going to go to the Treasury Department and take it for us? Mm-hmm. Or it's either going to come through some legislation or litigation. So Slick Rick has to come with a solution. That's a nice rap. But how do you address this agenda that we have here? We have a broad agenda, universal health care, education. So Slick Rick says don't vote. Slick Rick said, you know, like, bless of two evils. What does he want us to do? We can't rap our way out of this. So what does he want us to do? How does he keep daycare centers open? How does he make sure that we build more schools than prisons? You know, how does he make sure we bring the boys home from Iraq? How does he make sure that 50% of the black males that are unemployed in New York City get a job? I went to the city council and got $30 million put into a unemployment program for our people. What's Slick Rick going to do, give up the $30 million? You know, you know, that's a nice rap, but we want solutions. I'm sick of rap. I want some solutions.
That's the voice of Charles Barron. He is city council in New York City. He's running for mayor. He's here at the National Hip Hop Political Convention. And, man, you've been dropping a lot of gems on us, and I appreciate that. Before we let you go, you know, Anita had brought up, you know, Kerry and Bush and all that. Two questions. One, if Giuliani becomes, if he's on the vice presidential ticket, what do we need to look out for? And the second thing is, who do we vote if you think Kerry is evil and Bush is evil?
This is what I suggest we do right now. This is the game that they play with us. There is a convention, a Democratic convention in July. I say hold your vote, hold your commitment until after that convention. Don't let them even talk to us about Bush. Don't let them use Bush. We got to stop Bush or vote for Kerry. No, we got to start Kerry, not stop Bush. And their convention is in July. We got to say, we're not, I don't care what our black leaders say. They could have endorsed whoever they want already. Until the Democratic Party shift from the right of center, get away from free trade and go to fair trade, a strong on affirmative action and reparations, until they address our black agenda to build up the urban community, then we are holding our vote. I'm not telling you not to vote. Hold it until you get a commitment. And then we should make a decision after the convention.
Okay.
Because it's not about Bush and Kerry. It's about Kerry right now.
Okay.
And the Democrats not taking us for granted, playing boogeyman politics. We got to stop Bush. We got to stop Giuliani. No, we got to start Kerry and the Democrats being committed to this hip-hop agenda and our progressive agenda in this nation.
Do we look, for, do we look for a third party?
In the process of doing the two-party voting in November, we should build a third party so that we have an alternative. And then I think, I know this will never happen, but they should have a column, none of the above. And we should be able to vote for none of the above. And if none of the above beats the two candidates, then let's do it all over again until we get the right candidates.
I like that one. I like that one.
None of the above.
So there you have it. Charles Barron, not ex-Panther, Black Panther.
That's
freedom
right.
Fighter, running for the mayor of New York. He's here at the National Political Convention. I'm going to let you get back to the floor, and we want to thank you. And Anita went back out on the floor. We saw M1 from Dead Prez roll up in here, so we're going to try and get him. I think Chuck D is out here, and there's a lot of people coming through this afternoon,
sir.
And it's a beautiful thing. So once again, Charles Barron, thank you very much, and
thank
we'll be
you.
Talking to you soon.
Thank
okay.
you very much.
Peace.
Peace.
Thank you. You're listening to KBOO Portland.